Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. This week, HYBE defends buying into K-pop rival SM Entertainment. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Good afternoon.
As ever, we're going to take a look back at some of the biggest and most interesting music industry news stories of the last week. A week when the V&A in London acquired David Bowie's archive as a gift to the nation.
This nation, by the way, anybody listening who is not a citizen of the United Kingdom of both Great Britain and Northern Ireland, it's not a gift to you, so don't be getting all smug and excited. It's a gift to us.
Mm.
And let's face it, after recent years, in fact, some would say the death of David Bowie was the moment when it all went to shit.
I think so, yeah.
If you track back, I think we deserve a gift. I think we've...
Nothing has been good since then.
We've lived through some Nothing. Times that means we have collectively earned a gift. And so I'm glad... I don't know anything about this because I've not read this story, but I assume as the estate gifted this to the V&A?
They didn't gift it. I think the V&A's bought it.
Oh, right. So the gift...
the V&A is gifting it to us.
Right. Which, are they taxpayer
well,
funded?
They bought it for the good of us. I don't know that they could necessarily... I mean, I think the V&A's still going to own it.
Who funds the V&A? Do we fund the V&A?
Well,
because if we do, it's
I
a gift
tell
to
you,
ourselves.
I can answer these questions.
Go.
I can answer these questions, but there's things to say.
Good. Okay.
So the archive contains more than 80,000 items, some of which I think are very small, but they're counting all of them. And it features things from across Bowie's career from the 1960s up to his death in 2016. So it kind of covers everything. And how are they going to fit all that in the V&A, you're asking? That's what you're asking, isn't it? Because they did that exhibition, didn't they? Whenever that was, the David Bowie Is exhibition. And they fit some stuff in the V&A, but certainly not 80,000 things. How are they going to fit it all in there? They're not. They're not going to fit it all in there. They're going to build the David Bowie Centre for the Study of Performing Arts at the V&A East Storehouse in Stratford's Queen Elizabeth Olympic Park. That's what's happening.
Now I understand. And I've walked past that because occasionally, very occasionally, I walk through the wasteland that is the Queen Elizabeth Olympic Park.
It's the legacy. Oh, the legacy.
It's very windy. Whatever the weather is anywhere else in London, something about the Queen Elizabeth Olympic Park, it's always really windy. But at the top left-hand corner, as I'm looking at it now, there are a few universities, and I have gone to one of those to do some workshops and lectures about the music industry. And in order to get there, bearing in mind, I always get lost when I'm going there. But whichever route I take, I walk
past... Too distracted by the legacy.
I walk past the all-new V&A building, which I now know, thanks to this podcast, will at some point in the future host the David Bowie Centre for the Study of Performing Arts. That's something to look at. The gift is getting all the bigger as we talk about this.
Now, I believe your original question was actually, how is this funded?
Yeah, because if it's taxpayer funded, we've gifted it to ourselves. So I'm hoping it wasn't taxpayer funded.
No. The acquisition of the archive and the creation of the centre has been made possible thanks to the David Bowie estate and, it says here, a generous donation of £10 million from the Blavatnik Family Foundation and Warner Music Group. So that's nice of them.
So thanks to Len. So you were assuming that some of that 10 million is going to the estate, which is why the estate aren't gifting anything. But it could be that all that money is being spent on a new centre and the estate has gifted all this stuff. Could it not? Could that not also be an interpretation of that statement?
I mean, if you want to interpret that statement I just read out there, it does seem like that's what's happened.
So anybody, somebody, we don't know who... Definitely a bit of Len Blavatnik, owner of most of the Warner Music Group. Obviously, it actually has other shareholders these days. And with some support, maybe lots of support of the estate and the team at the V&A, which I've always thought is the most boring museum in London. But once they get this stuff in there, maybe it will cease to be the most boring museum in London. Now, not only that, it'll be the bit that's near where I live that will have all the interesting stuff rather than the endless fabrics and vases, which is what I seem to remember from the one time I went to the main V&A in Kensington.
I don't think that's a museum for you. I'm surprised you've been there.
I went to the restaurant. I met someone there for lunch. That was the one time I've been to the V&A. But anyway, I'm glad we've got that gift. I'm feeling better for it.
Yes, this is the turning point. This is when everything starts getting good again.
Let's draw a line in the sand and say that was the bad times. And now we've got this gift. It's all going to be fine. There'll be tomatoes everywhere for people not listening in the UK. Apparently there's a tomato.
I've got a tomato.
There's a tomato shortage in the UK. I say apparently because I don't eat tomatoes, so it doesn't really affect me. Actually, it did affect me, but I'm not sure we've got time to explain why. There's also a pepper shortage. And when I went to my local fish and chip shop the other day...
Oh, I got some nice peppers. Tomatoes are a problem.
I don't cook. I don't eat peppers. But I did go to my local fish and chip shop the other day, put in my order, and then said, while it's cooking, I'm going to go to the supermarket to buy some stuff. And the woman in the fish and chip shop asked me to buy her some peppers. Because they must have something that involves peppers. But there weren't any peppers because, as I've just mentioned, there are no tomatoes or peppers. So anyway, it did actually affect me. But, and I cannot stress this enough, and I know that I say this every week on Setlist, but this week, I really mean it. This is not what we're here to talk about on this podcast.
So not. No, later on, we'll be discussing why TikTok is definitely evil. But first, Park Ji-won, the CEO of K-pop powerhouse HYBE, has been forced to defend his company's recent acquisition of shares in rival SM Entertainment after its management hit out at the deal. Park insists that his company's plan is good for the South Korean music business and the K-pop genre as a whole.
So HYBE, I'm sure you all know, is the company that used to be called Big Hit. It still actually has a division using that name. And of course, is best known, certainly on a global basis, as being the company behind the phenomenon that it's a hiatus, remember, is BTS. But also has had lots of other successes in the world of K-pop, but beyond K-pop, because of course there is also now HYBE America, because the HYBE company did the big deal with Scooter Braun in the US. So as well as being a really big player in the South Korean music industry and wider entertainment business, also becoming quite a significant player in the US industry as well. So there have been lots of stories and announcements coming out of the HYBE machine in recent months. But the recent story, and certainly in the context of the South Korean music industry, this has been a pretty big story in the last couple of weeks, because HYBE basically announced a couple of weeks ago that it had bought a 14.8% stake in SM Entertainment, which is another big entertainment music company in South Korea with lots of interest in the K-pop world. And then once it had confirmed that it was in the process of acquiring this 14.8% stake, it then revealed that that was just the start of it. It had ambitions of buying more shares from other shareholders in SM Entertainment to get its shareholding up to 40%, which would basically give it a controlling interest in that rival business. It bought that initial 14.8% stake in SM Entertainment by doing one deal with one shareholder, the person who is actually, or was prior to this deal, the single biggest shareholder in SM Entertainment, which is the company's founder, Lee Soo Man. And when the initial acquisition of that shareholding by HYBE was announced, a statement was put out by both Lee Soo Man, but also the high-profile founder of HYBE itself, Bang Si-hook. And in that joint statement, they said that this alliance between two big names in the K-pop world was important, and that they had worked to bring the two companies closer together because they wanted to achieve their shared vision of upgrading K-pop's global competitiveness.
However, that deal was not backed by the management of SM, who had just agreed their own partnership with internet company Kakao, that has its own entertainment business and operates the South Korean music streaming service Melon. And for his part, Lee Soo Man is not backing that deal. He not only objects to it, but he's seeking an injunction through the courts to block it. So you can see why a certain amount of controversy has blown up around this deal. And the SM management team have become increasingly vocal since that deal was done earlier this month in opposing Hybe's ambitions to boost its shareholding in the company to 40%. SM's CFO Yang Chul-hyuk posted a lengthy statement to YouTube calling Hybe's current moves a hostile takeover and insisted that it will be bad news for SM's artists and other shareholders. He also said that Hybe's share purchase was hindering the SM management's big plans for expanding and revitalizing the company, while a combined Hybe and SM would create competition concerns for the South Korean music market too.
But not so, says the aforementioned Park Ji-won, CEO of Hybe. After the CFO of SM put that video up on YouTube, which was an interesting video to go and watch. It has subtitles, so you don't have to speak Korean to know what he's saying. After that video had been posted, Bloomberg quoted the Hybe CEO as basically saying that the plan to bring Hybe and SM together was, in fact, really good for the South Korean music business and for the K-pop genre. He also said that there were concerns at Hybe that, although clearly K-pop has gone through a period of, you know, significant growth and success in recent years, that maybe that growth is slowing, maybe that growth is going to peak at some point, and therefore now was the time to bring these two big K-pop companies together to capitalize on what has been built in recent years and to ensure that it continues into the future. He said the most glorious days are the most dangerous period for a company, and that they are constantly afraid that people might just stop listening to K-pop one day, and that K-pop companies need to be working together to ensure that never happens. Noting the fact, as you say, that the founder of SM had gone legal to try and block the SM management team's own deal with the internet company Kakao, he said that while he can't elaborate on that matter, because obviously legal proceedings are pending, he said actually Hybe themselves don't have a problem with that partnership going ahead if it is in the best interests of SM and its artists and its shareholders. So that was the initial sort of pushback we got from the boss of Hybe after we'd had this video from the CFO of SM.
Then later in the week on Wednesday, Park confirmed publicly that Hybe's initial SM share purchase had been completed and wrote an open letter saying that his company had resolved the governance issue between former chief producer Lee and SM during the course of the share acquisition, saying SM will be moving to become a company with a transparent governance structure that prioritises shareholder value. He then went on to explain why this whole alliance between these two big K-pop companies was totally fine, saying, as leaders and pioneers of the K-pop industry, both Hybe and SM have been triumphing on the global stage. Hybe's vision to become a leading global entertainment lifestyle platform company under its mission We Believe in Music is closely interconnected with the goal of SM 3.0, which is what SM is calling its plans for growth. So closely interconnected with the goal of SM 3.0 to leap forward as a fan and shareholder-centered global entertainment company.
It's quite interesting, those of us here in the UK and in the West, looking at how this story has been unfolding in South Korea and some of the sort of cultural differences, because this statement that was put out by the CEO of Hybe on Hybe's social media channels, and it was in English as well as in Korean, but it was a statement that was addressing both the company's shareholders and the artists who work with SM and the fans of those artists, all in one statement. And of course, you know, here in the UK, generally speaking, you know, big music companies that have lots of shareholders obviously do shareholder communications, and, you know, we all tune in and watch those, but they tend to be quite separate, don't they? Today we're talking to our shareholders, and then we'll do an event behind closed doors aimed at our artists, and then we'll talk to the fans over here. So it was culturally quite interesting seeing them all being communicated to in one open letter. In some ways, it's quite nice to not be having to pretend to the fans that you're not a corporate entity with shareholders. But anyway, another thing that was addressed in this open letter, and I guess this was more targeted at the artists who are signed to SM and their fans, and also possibly the people who work at SM. And basically what he was saying was that HYBE, I guess like, you know, quite a lot of the big entertainment companies around the world, within the group, they have lots of different labels and divisions, and those labels and divisions generally have quite a lot of autonomy to operate as they wish, to sign the artists that they want to work with. And so what he was basically saying, yes, HYBE's ambition is to basically have a controlling stake in SM Entertainment, but that doesn't mean that HYBE bosses want to get hands-on involved and interfere with what SM are doing, what SM's artists are doing, basically saying that, you know, we will allow the SM teams and the SM labels to carry on doing what they're doing, working with the artists. But he reckoned that by bringing the two companies together, there are benefits for both sides because they both have infrastructure that each other can benefit from. I think it's also true to say that when it comes to success beyond South Korea itself, whereas HYBE, as we've already mentioned, is now quite active in the US and has also had some success in South America and in India. Meanwhile, SM and its artists have had quite a lot of success in places like China and especially Japan and elsewhere in Southeast Asia. So he was basically saying, we're not going to interfere day to day in the running of SM, but by coming together, SM benefits from HYBE's reach into the US and the Americas. Meanwhile, HYBE benefits from SM's existing reach into China and Japan, etc. Hey, it's all going to be brilliant, I guess, is the summary of what he was saying.
Then towards the end of the letter, he seemed to turn his attention to the members of the SM management who might still not be quite so on board with HYBE buying into their company, saying, I hope the management can come to a wise and reasonable conclusion to ensure that our shared visions and business directions are on the right track. And if they do that, he reckoned, they can stand shoulder to shoulder with the world's major record labels.
So as we say, in a single letter, a rallying call to everybody, basically to the shareholders, to the management at SM, the employees at SM, all the artists who work with SM and their fans, basically trying to reassure everybody, it's going to be great, it's going to be brilliant. Together, we're going to ensure the continued success and growth of K-pop. And here in South Korea, we'll have music companies that are as significant globally as Sony, Universal, Warner, etc. This is kind of what he was saying. I'm not sure it's going to allay the concern. Well, maybe it will allay the concerns of the employees and artists at SM. I'm not sure that the management team there, given what they were saying and the way they were saying it earlier in the week, I'm not sure that single letter will be able to solve all of that in one go. But we will see. Interesting times in the South Korean music industry in the last couple of weeks. And if I have to rewrite the word HYBE in lowercase anymore, because we decided that when they rebranded as HYBE, even though they insist on writing it in capital letters, we write it in little letters because we have weird rules at CMU on who's allowed to have all caps. But he wrote HYBE in capital letters a lot in that letter. And every time I pulled a quote out of it, I had to go in and retype HYBE in lowercase. So hopefully they'll solve all of this, and then we won't have to write about them for a few more weeks, and I don't have to go through articles changing HYBE to HYBE. Hey, should ByteDance get its intercap D? That's another CMU style guide conversation that maybe we'll talk about in the final section of Setlist.
I don't know that this is the place for it, but whatever. Yeah. And finally, on this week's edition of Setlist, we're back again to TikTok. Two more US senators have raised concerns about TikTok and its Chinese parent company ByteDance, and what access the Chinese government has to TikTok's users and user data. So Democrat Richard Blumenthal and Republican Jerry Moran have aired their concerns in a new letter to the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States.
Now, of course, and we've probably talked about it before on Setlist, I can't really remember. We've definitely reported on it in the CMU Daily. There have been pretty significant concerns amongst political groups, certainly in the US, but actually in lots of other countries as well, about what access the Chinese government may or may not have to this user data for the TikTok global platform through the Chinese parent company ByteDance. And in the US, you might remember when Donald Trump was still president, based on those concerns, he tried to ban TikTok. It was not successful, and there were various legal challenges to the ban that stopped it ever going into effect. And then when Joe Biden became president, he basically got rid of the ban. That said, as you've already alluded to, by name-checking and confirming the political allegiances of the two senators behind this new letter, it's not that in the context of US politics, it's the Republicans who are concerned about TikTok and the Democrats are like, it's fine, whatever. It is an issue that concerns people on both sides of the political spectrum. And the debate has continued in the US, even though Trump's ban never went into effect. So this committee that you mentioned that this new letter went to is the Committee on Foreign Investments in the United States. And it has been looking into issues around TikTok throughout this whole process, actually, initially by investigating TikTok's acquisition of Musical.ly all the way back in 2017, because if you remember, on a global basis, it was originally Musical.ly that became very popular, with people initially mainly doing lip-syncing videos. Musical.ly was also a Chinese company, but it had a proper headquarters in the US. And when ByteDance / TikTok bought Musical.ly and then used it to sort of, you know, really relaunch and get TikTok going on a global basis, this committee did look into that and has been looking into it ever since. And as a result, has been looking at the various allegations that have been made about the way that ByteDance and TikTok deals with the user data of its American users. But I think what these senators were saying, you've been looking at this Committee on Foreign Investments in the United States for quite a long time now. Yes, Trump's ban was objected to in the courts and it was ultimately abolished, but the concerns definitely remain on both Republicans and Democrats in Washington, and it feels like maybe this committee should complete its investigation and make some changes to make sure that US user data on TikTok is not being accessed by the Chinese government to pursue whatever devious things that it is that the Chinese government are supposedly trying to do with all that information.
So most of this letter focuses on various media reports about how TikTok's Chinese headquarters has accessed user data relating to its American users. So they cite a report in Forbes saying that ByteDance acknowledged that staff based in China and the United States had spied on the private data of journalists and others in order to identify sources behind articles critical of the company. It also references a Wall Street Journal report that TikTok's product development and management continues to be based in China, including its opaque and powerful algorithmic recommendation system. And not only that, they go on, but concerns about ByteDance's control over TikTok are further exacerbated by the backgrounds of its staff. One investigation by Forbes found that 300 current employees at TikTok and ByteDance previously, or in some cases concurrently, worked for Chinese propaganda outlets such as Xinhua News Agency and China Global Television. The senators also expressed concern regarding the data generated by TikTok's digital advertising tools and its systems for filtering content, saying, TikTok has a troubling history of censoring videos critical of the Chinese government and other authoritarian regimes. It has removed or hidden videos related to Tiananmen Square and Tibetan independence, criticism of Vladimir Putin, and the persecution of Uyghur Muslims in Xinjiang, among other topics.
So with all of that in mind, the two senators in their letter said that they urge prompt action by this committee to protect consumers and our national security through concluding the investigation underway and imposing strong remedies to separate ByteDance from TikTok's American users. At a minimum, they then said, the committee should ensure that executive decision-making about the platform is based in the US and fully free from the coercive influence of Beijing. It must also ensure that decisions about and access to all personal data algorithms and content moderation relating to American users is out of the reach or influence of the Chinese government.
Now, the boss of TikTok, Zhou Jiuquan, is actually due to face the questions of US Congress members, albeit in the House of Representatives, at a session of the House Energy and Commerce Committee next month. And it will be interesting there to see if anything he says allays any of the ongoing concerns of US politicians regarding TikTok data practices. And as well as that, further afield, last week the European Commission banned staff there from having the TikTok app on any work devices or personal devices that have work-related apps on them. And in a statement said, to protect the Commission's data and increase its cybersecurity, the EC Corporate Management Board has decided to suspend the TikTok application on corporate devices and personal devices enrolled in the Commission mobile device service.
Now, in the interest of balance, we should point out that TikTok continues to deny that there are any issues with ByteDance in China and certainly the Chinese government having access to user data and users on the TikTok global platform, and it regularly puts out statements to that effect in the US and in Europe and elsewhere when politicians raise these concerns. A spokesperson for TikTok in response to this announcement from the European Commission last week told Politico, "We are disappointed with this decision, which we believe to be misguided and based on fundamental misconceptions. We have contacted the Commission to set the record straight and explain how we protect the data of the 125 million people across the EU who come to TikTok every month." So TikTok insisting still that there are no problems, even though the concerns are rising around the world. I mean, obviously, some of this is linked to wider geopolitics and disputes between Western governments and the Chinese governments. But those concerns definitely not going away. I've actually deleted TikTok off my phone. The app is no longer on my phone, although that's slightly less to do with my concerns about the Chinese government getting my data. I operate on the assumption that the Chinese and Russian and other governments have access to any data they want anyway. Whatever devices you are using, maybe almost into conspiracy theory territory there. I need a new iPhone, and I'm at that point with my existing phone where I keep having to delete apps in order to get it to work. And so the TikTok app has gone on the basis that I've only actually used it twice. But I am now a big consumer of TikTok content because pretty much all of TikTok's content, as far as I can see, ends up on YouTube in YouTube Shorts. So if they do start banning TikTok in countries, hey, TikTok users, if you go and open up YouTube Shorts, I know it's kind of old school using YouTube, but pretty much everything you can see on TikTok, as far as I can see, is also on YouTube Shorts. But I guess if anyone from TikTok is listening, hey, everybody, use TikTok. It's brilliant. There's no concerns. It's all fine. I am sure. Is that balanced?
I don't even know anymore.
It was certainly...
It certainly could be.
Was not succinct enough to go on TikTok itself.
No. Barely got on this.
If somebody wants to, I don't know, put the audio into some transcription software and run it through an AI tool, maybe somebody can work out what position I ended up taking in my conclusion.
Well, we could speed it up, can't we?
My conclusion.
We'll speed it up like they do with the music and stick it on TikTok.
That's true. Sometimes they slow the music down to the extent now that labels are...
I don't think we want to slow that down.
No, that's true.
Some no labels, amount of reverb is going to save that.
Some labels are now... putting out speeded up and slowed down versions of their tracks ready for TikTok in addition to the original. Did you see, we reported on it, didn't we, that Ben Folds got a new album coming out. Obviously, I'm a big Ben Folds fan. And he was talking about how this was definitely the album that was created to listen to from beginning to end, etc., etc. And it's sort of like, yeah, in a world where we're getting to the point now where the fans only want 30 seconds that they can speed up. They're not interested in the rest of the album. But there you go. Yeah.
I'm not sure how many Ben Folds fans are big TikTok users, to be fair.
No, that's probably
I think he might have cornered the album listening market.
He may well have done. Although I'm a Ben Folds fan and a YouTube Shorts viewer. So almost in that territory. Who knows? Anyway, should we finish?
I can't believe we haven't. I can't believe this is still going on.
Let's wrap up this podcast.
All right. That, I mean, completely belying the conceit that there's any sort of time limit on this. But that's all we've got time for on this edition of Setlist. If you want to read anything more about anything we've discussed here, except for what Chris is doing with his phone, I haven't written anything about that. Maybe by Monday there'll be an article about that. Anyway,
I'll make a TikTok video all about it.
Oh, God. There's show notes. There's links. You can find the links. I haven't got time to tell you where anymore. Subscribe to the show. Rate and review the show. Email us. setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by Andy Moulton, Chris Cook. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.